From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the interview I recorded with Jon Stewart last month at the 92nd Street Y in New York. We broadcast part of that 90-minute interview earlier this month. This time, we have a different edit that incorporates stories about The Daily Show, Stewart's life, and his views of the news media that we didn't have time for the first time around. Here's something he said I really relate to about having to absorb a lot of information every day and night to prepare for the next interview.
I take it in and suddenly I'm an expert on the construction of the Pentagon. And then by 8 o'clock that night, I'm like, I didn't know there was a building with five sides, you know.
My onstage interview with Jon Stewart, including portions of the conversation we haven't yet broadcast, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From Subaru, where all vehicles are built in zero landfill plants. Love, it's what makes a Subaru. And from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar cheese, and offering recipes, stories, and programs for schools at cabotcheese.coop.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. So maybe you heard our interview with Jon Stewart that we broadcast October 4th. Because I recorded a 90-minute interview with him, there were a lot of interesting things he had to say about his life, his show, and his views on the news media that we didn't have time for during our broadcast. So today, we have a different edit of that interview with lots of new material. Jon Stewart has been hosting The Daily Show on Comedy Central since 1999. The show's two Peabodys and 11 Emmys are examples of the widely held opinion that he's a brilliant satirist of politics and the media. He's been in the news a lot lately because of his rally to restore sanity, which will be held next Saturday on the National Mall. On the website, it's described as, quote, a rally for the people who think shouting is annoying, who feel that the loudest voices shouldn't be the only ones that get heard. If we had to sum up the political view of our participants in a single sentence, we couldn't. That's sort of the point, unquote. The occasion for my interview with Jon Stewart was the publication of the new Daily Show book, Earth, A Visitor's Guide to the Human Race. Our interview was recorded September 29th before an audience at the 92nd Street Y in New York, which is famous for its lecture series, its lyrics and lyricist series, and its programs about Jewish life. I asked Stewart first about the rally. So it's the Million Moderate March to take it down a notch for America. And everyone is trying to figure out, is this a new breed of comedy festival, or is this like a political march to bring out the vote, particularly like the younger voters? Like, right. Tell us what it really is.
Well, when we figure out what it is, Terry.
You're going to call me?
We're going to be delighted. First of all, I want to thank everybody for coming out. It's an honor to be at the 92nd Street Y, which, I don't know if you know this, the third holiest site in the Jewish religion. It's very exciting for me to be here. There's the, I believe it's the Wailing Wall, Zabar's, and I think you why. So, obviously for me, this is an honor, and it's a...
But what is the march?
The march is, like everything that we do, the march is merely a construct. It's just a format, in the same way that the book is a format. You know, a show is a format, a book is a format, to translate the type of expression that we do, whether it be a satire on the political events. It's a format to be filled with the type of material that Stephen and I do and the point of view. So it's not, you know, people have said it's a rally to counter Glenn Beck. It's not. It's what it is we saw that and thought, what a beautiful outline, what a beautiful structure to fill with what we want to express in live form, festival form.
Now, are you nervous at all that tens of thousands of people are going to leave their homes and travel long distance because you asked them to?
Yeah.
And anytime there's this like huge rally
right.
in the National Mall.
You're saying, am I a Jew?
Exactly. No,
I'm nervous about it.
It's like worse than throwing a wedding or something. I mean,
no, I'm nervous about traffic. I'm nervous about everything.
No, I know, but it's like.
I'm nervous. I would like to see a bus that's just filled with Purell go down there. I don't, you know. I'm nervous for everybody. I don't want people to get sick. I don't want them. We're at the rally. We're going to be. We're going to have. You know how rallies usually have like things you can buy. We're going to sell scarves. I mean, it's the end of October. It could get chilly.
Now, you made The Daily Show a much more political show than it was before you came, because
right.
it was it pre-existed you, but you completely changed the show. And before I ask you about how doing the show changed you, I want to play you a short clip of what Stephen Colbert said. When Stephen Colbert was on our show the first time a few years ago...
How did you get access to him? Because I call over there all the time. He's a very busy man.
This is what Stephen Colbert said about being on your show and working with you and becoming more political. Here it is.
When I got to The Daily Show, they asked me to have a political opinion. Or rather, John did. John asked me to have a political opinion, and it turned out that I had one. And I didn't realize quite how liberal I was until I was asked to make passionate comedic choices as opposed to necessarily successful comedic choices.
So he feels that he became more political because you pushed him to make passionate political choices in humor. Did doing the show make you more political than you ever expected to be? More politically aware, more politically engaged?
I think it made me less political and more emotional. The closer you spend time with the political and the media process, the less political you become and the more viscerally upset you become at corruption. So it's I don't consider it political, because political I always sort of denote as a partisan endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
But I have become increasingly unnerved by just the depth of corruption that exists at many different levels. I'm less upset about politicians than the media. I feel like politicians, there is a certain inherent, you know, the way I always explain it is, when you go to the zoo and a monkey throws his feces, it's a monkey. But when the zookeeper's standing right there and he doesn't say bad monkey, somebody's got to be the zookeeper. And that's, so I tend to feel much more strongly about the abdication of responsibility by the media than by political advocates. They're representing a constituency. And the media, you know, our culture is just a series of checks and balances. That's why I'm never, you know, the whole idea that we're in suddenly a battle for between tyranny and freedom, it's a series of pendulum swings. And the swings have become less drastic over time. That's why I feel sort of not sanguine, but at least a little bit less frightful in that our pendulum swings have become less and less. But what has changed is, I think, the media's sense of their ability to be responsible arbiters, or I think they feel fearful. I think there is this whole idea now that there's a liberal media conspiracy, and so if they feel like they express any moral authority or judgment, which is what you would imagine is editorial control, that they will be vilified. Or I honestly don't know what it is.
So it strikes me that your interviews have gotten more serious over the years. Not all of them, but some of them. Most famous, Jim Cramer. One of the most famous, Jim Cramer, which basically held him and CNBC responsible for the financial meltdown because they weren't really reporting it. And what I mean by that is you accused him of being able to see this coming, of knowing mm-hmm. the things happening behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So what were the repercussions of it? Because he certainly...
He was sad.
He was sad.
Yeah.
I think he expected something more humorous. And you,
probably.
Really wondering is how it left you feeling about doing really serious interviews with somebody.
Well, I don't care for it. I'm not, you know, I think I've done, you know, three like that in 12 years. The intention is never to go out there and be humorless and sanctimonious. Not that I can't do that, you know, and have shown that in the past. But some of it is the alchemy of the person's reaction to how it's being presented to them, their reaction. If there are moments in a conversation where you become infuriated, but that's never, it's never the goal. And the entire sort of ideology of how it all happened is silly. We were basically making a case, the Jim Cramer Bear Stearns stuff that we ran, and I don't know if anybody's familiar with it, but it was, you know, right before Bear Stearns went from, you know, $60 to 6 cents, you know, like that week he was like, Bear Stearns, you'll love it, you know, and then he hit the button and they're like, waka waka, you know, that whole thing. So we had done that a year ago. And so when we put it back in, it was all a reaction to, there was a gentleman named Rick Santelli who'd gone on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and had done, this was his famous sort of Tea Party rant. And it was about the irresponsibility of homeowners and how dare the taxpayers have to bail out irresponsible homeowners who had taken loans that they were unable to pay off. And I thought that was an incredibly arrogant statement coming from somebody who worked for CNBC, a 24-hour news network devoted to financial analysis, who call themselves experts, how was their judgment? So that was the whole way that the bit came about was, you're yelling about the judgment of individual homeowners who took on loans that they didn't realize were going to bury them, or they didn't know that the values would go underwater. Let's go back and check your judgment. And it was just a 10-minute clip package of them being wrong.
Right.
He was one very small part of it, but he poked his head up and went, that was unfair. That was out of context. So I said, because we don't want to take people out of context, hey guys, I thought we checked this out. go back and check. Because if that's not fair, we should actually come up with a way to figure that out. Well, it turns out not only was it fair, but there was a whole other Christmas box filled with predictions.
Right.
So what do you do in that situation? You put those together. Then you put that out there, and then he goes, that's it, I'm coming on. I mean, they called us and said, can he come on? And,
oh.
And there was no, you know, they made a whole thing like, well, they promised they wouldn't do that. No, we didn't. We didn't promise anything. In fact, I went back there right before the interview and said, look, man, this probably isn't going to be a pleasant conversation. I hope it'll be fair. See you out there.
One of the amazing things you did on your show, after South Park did its Prophet Muhammad sequence over the summer, and the whole idea was that, you know, the Prophet Muhammad was like hiding in a truck, I think, like under a shroud or something.
Bear suit.
In a bear suit, right. And you're not supposed to depict the Prophet Muhammad visually.
Especially in a bear suit.
But it turned out it was really Santa Claus. It wasn't the Prophet Muhammad. But,
and then at the end, you were like, geez, why was Santa really hiding? It didn't really make a lot of sense.
But still, a lot of people, I think a lot of Muslims were very angry at even
I don't
the
think even a lot were.
It,
I think there were certain
some
extremist groups that
yes, right.
expressed their
and there were,
outrage.
And there were death threats, I think, against...
I believe that's correct.
Yes, the creators of South Park. And you did an incredible thing afterwards. You devoted a segment to it, and then you said, I say to anyone who's threatening death in the name of religion or politics... And then a gospel group came out, and then, do you want to say what you did?
I believe the phrase was, go f*** yourself.
Yes.
And then we danced and sang. Can I tell you the most difficult thing about that? Finding a gospel group that'll sing, go f*** yourself. I tell you, they're not easy to find. We call a lot of churches, and we're like, do you have a gospel group? Yes, we do. Would they possibly come on and sing, go f*** yourself? And they're like, yeah... We can do Amazing Grace. Can you do, you know, so the negotiations to get them up there were difficult. But, I think the lesson that I sort of took from all that is, again, there's a difference between disagreeing with people, like newscasters on Fox News that I think are incorrect in their analysis of the day's events, and people that threaten to kill you for putting a cartoon image of Muhammad in a bear suit. And that's a line that we too often forget. And it's very easy to dehumanize, and I will say in this room, I would imagine, you know, Beck and Palin are easier punching bags, and we can think of it as, oh my God, I'm so scared if they take over. And you know what? We'll be fine. You know, we had a civil war. Just, we're not that fragile. And I think we always have to remember that people can be opponents, but not enemies. And there are enemies in the world. We just need the news media to help us delineate. And I think that's where the failing is, that the culture of corruption that exists in the media doesn't allow us to delineate between enemies and opponents. And that's where we sort of fall into trouble.
No, in terms of consequences.
We are the world. Yeah. We are. Love on the rocks. Ain't no surprise. Something.
That's good.
No lies.
That's good. Okay.
Maybe we were born to run.
So you were doing comedy long before The Daily Show.
Yes.
So what was your comedy like before it became a critique of politics and media?
Mostly balloons. It was a critique of religion and politics and media. It was my feelings on that, but in a much less savvy form, a much less technically aware form, a much less educated form. Our process has allowed us to extend it. You know, the amount of material that we go through in a day now, I mean, it took me 6 years to write my first, you know, 45 minutes.
What was in the first 45 minutes? Tell us something that was in it.
There was, let's see, you know, it was so long ago, this 1980, there was a lot of Saddam Hussein stuff. I don't know if you remember that guy. There was stuff about, I remember, the first Persian Gulf War where, again, it was this idea that, you know, everyone was afraid it was going to be another Vietnam. I think the joke was, you know, it was going to be another Vietnam. We can't go in there. It's going to be another Vietnam. And then the whole war lasted 2 days. It wasn't even another Woodstock. You know, it was that kind of thing. or that you know, there's a lot of those types of issues still. It was actually a lot of religious stuff sort of working out. A comedian's first 15 minutes is typically about his life. I'm a, you know, your first joke is usually who you are. You just kind of walk out and go, I'm a Jew who was raised in New Jersey, joke. You know, it's, and then you work through your family and, you know, you basically go through your entire history with them and then you sit and stare at them, but they're not doing much. So you have to then spread out. So then your next jokes usually come from where you go on the road. So I've taken my act about being a Jew from New Jersey to Tennessee. Want to hear about Tennessee? You know, and then that's your next.
Yeah.
Your next act is about your life as a comedian. And then when that's exhausted, you tend to turn your vision to the world, and that becomes sort of your tableau for the rest of your career, at least in the instances that I've seen.
We'll hear more of my onstage interview with Jon Stewart after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with Jon Stewart last month at the 92nd Street Y in New York. You got MTV shows earlier in your career and worked on other shows, but when your MTV interview show was discontinued, you went on Letterman's show right afterwards.
Right. No.
Was it another show that was discontinued?
Yeah, there was an MTV show, and then it was bought by the guy, Arsenio Hall was on, and he had a dog pound.
Right, yeah.
And then he left.
Right.
And they thought, who's going to look out for the dog pound? So they hired me because what a perfect line of succession that would be. I have an idea. Let's bring in the opposite of him. So that lasted a very short time. And that was the thing.
That was the thing that was canceled.
That was the thing that got canceled. And I went on Letterman that night. Although was scheduled to be on Letterman, not... It was happenstance more than it was.
Right. So what you said to Letterman was that you were thinking of going to L.A., but in L.A. everyone tries to tell you who you are. And in your case, they tell you, you're a younger Richard Lewis, you're a younger Jerry Seinfeld, which means I'm a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's what they were telling you who you were, who did you think you were then?
That's one of the things that I think I pride myself on, is not thinking about that.
Yeah.
You know, I never in my career have ever thought about what... the goal was. The goal was always to be better than I was at the present time at what I was doing. As a stand-up, my break in stand-up was not getting on Letterman. My break in stand-up was, there's a place called the Comedy Cellar in the Village on McDougal Street. And a great group of guys that were together in those days performing. And they put me on every night at 2 a.m. I was the last guy on every night. And not on the weekends, because I wasn't good enough for weekends. So Sunday night through Thursday night, it was me and drunk Dutch tourists in a basement in the Village. And I would perform for the plate of hummus that would be served to me. Because above the Comedy Cellar is a Middle Eastern restaurant, because of course. And I went on every night, and I learned the difference between impersonating a comedian and being a comedian. And that was my break, was learning how to be authentic, not to the audience, but to myself. I developed a baseline of confidence and also insecurity. I knew how bad I was and I knew how good I was. And that is what helped me through a lot of the ups and downs as we went along.
You're much more comfortable at the anchor desk on The Daily Show than standing up in front of a microphone?
No. I love stand-up comedy.
Okay.
And the anchor desk to me feels more of an artifice than the show as it's done. I understand the practice of it. Performing the show is the last thing I think about. My day is writing and rewriting the show.
Uh-huh.
And then a lot of times it'd be like, okay, let's go. Right, right. And then you think about it. But that to me is artifice. I like the crafting of it.
Tell us a little bit about what the morning meeting is like.
The morning meeting is, as we call it, our morning cup of sadness. We get in around, you'd be incredibly surprised at how regimented our day is, and just how the infrastructure of the show is very much mechanized. It, you know, we come in and it's not, people always think, the Daily Show, you guys probably just sit around and make jokes. And we've instituted, to be able to sort of wean through all this material and synthesize it and try and come up with things to do, we have a very kind of strict day that we have to adhere to. And by doing that, that allows us to process everything and gives us the freedom to sort of improvise. I'm a real believer in that creativity comes from limits, not freedom. Freedom, I think, you don't know what to do with yourself. But when you have a structure, then you can improvise off it and feel confident enough to kind of come back to that. So the morning meeting is at 9 o'clock. And what we've done is we have, I guess you'd call them mole people, that live in a little subterranean area of our building. And they are charged with watching all of these shows. And they are just tragic, tragic individuals. They are, they live lives of true sadness. They are, they're mole people. They are, someday they will be free. And we will all celebrate their freedom. George Bush will come in and free them. So the morning meeting is, it's typically, what are the top stories and how have they been covered? We have a 9 o'clock meeting and a 3 o'clock meeting. The 9 o'clock is to kind of rehash the sort of analysis that we were going over the night before to see if the premises and hypotheses that we had come up with the night before have come to pass. And what's the video evidence? And then we take that and we sort of, then we begin to knit it together for writing assignments. And then those writing assignments are usually coming back in at 11:30, at which point we begin to read them. There's really, my day is very interesting. Then we read them and go over the notes of how we want to attack it. We don't have enough there. We'll push it back out to the writers. They'll come back at 12:30. And the day basically goes as sort of a little dance of collaboration between writing and rewriting and including all the other elements of graphics and all those kinds of things to put together.
We'll hear more of my interview with Jon Stewart in the second half of the show. It was recorded on stage at the 92nd Street Y in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Jon Stewart, recorded on stage at the 92nd Street Y in New York, including questions from the audience that we didn't hear in our first broadcast of the interview early this month.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the effectiveness of charitable giving at fjc.org. From Plowshares Fund, dedicated to helping build a safe, secure, and nuclear weapon-free world at plowshares.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of the interview I recorded with Jon Stewart September 29th on stage at the 92nd Street Y in New York. We broadcast part of that interview on October 4th, but now we're going to hear material we didn't have time for during our first broadcast, including questions that came from the audience.
So you were voted most funny person in high school. What got you that honor?
It was mostly the political stuff. And the
religious
stuff.
Sure.
You know, I was obnoxious. I was obnoxious. And people in New Jersey in the late 70s dug that, man. you know, I think I always, it's not like I was morose and then suddenly went into comedy. I mean, I was a I guess what you would consider back then a pain in the ass.
So was this from, like, did you have a stage or something to be funny on, or were you just, like, funny in the halls, or?
No, I had a stage. A little stage set up, and then people would come by and go, hey, what are you going to, geometry class? Nice shirt. Does it come in men's? Boom. You know, that kind of,
I mean, were you performing? Were you in shows? Were you in?
I was not in the theater. I was into sports, and
that's funny.
Well, I had the dream. I had the dream that I would not have Bud Harrelson's body. I thought I would have. Perhaps I would grow into something. So I wanted to be an athlete. I didn't want to be in show business. It was a very different world, and I know a lot of people here are of that era. It was not. We were not in the world where everybody was special yet. We had not entered into that stage of where everybody had a Facebook page that they could personalize with tunes they love. And, you know, my kids will never know what it's like to have nothing to watch, because there's, like, they will, I mean, I'm surprised that when we have human interactions, they don't, like, go, let me freeze that and just run that back. Like, they're accustomed to things being presented to them when they want it in exactly the form that they want it. And they're accustomed to the idea that I'm special and I can do anything. And if I do it, just by the very nature of me doing it, it is in fact then special. I came from the era of, you're not special. Don't, well, you think you're special? You're not so special.
Jewish parents can be very good at giving you that
message. Oh, no, my part, listen, yeah. My mom, I mean, that's not her, but that was the culture of the time. She was, I think, an anomaly in that era. You know, she had, there was like a quiet confidence because she had to fend for herself, you know, divorced in the 70s and that sort of thing. So I think she had a very different outlook, but that the community at large was not like that. The community at large was, yeah, you're going to move to New York. Yeah. Hey, good luck at the gay pride parade. Yeah. You know,
Mr. Big Shot. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's not, it wasn't about empowerment and creativity. I had no sense of this world of expression that existed out there.
Okay, so when you were 13 and you were bar mitzvahed, what was the music that was...
Do we have footage of that too? This is going to be interesting.
What was the music that was played at your bar mitzvah? Was there a band? Was there a DJ?
The music that was played, I guess, and what was Tonight's the Night. I think the theme was Under the Sea.
Did you have a theme?
No. Good. Again, this is before people like hired the Yankees to come to the bar mitzvah. This is, I believe at the time, the announcement after the bar mitzvah was, and I think there's pound cake in the back, enjoy. Yeah. So, it was, you know, and I think I was on crutches at the time. And so I do.
Seriously?
I do have actually.
Were you seriously on crutches?
I was seriously on crutches. I'd broken my ankle.
Was it a sports injury?
It was a gang fight. we'd had a rumble. I think it was Mathletes versus. It was I. You know what I had been doing? I think I had been playing basketball on a skateboard. I did a lot of that though, and I went to the emergency room a lot because I was always trying things like that. Like,
were you really?
Yeah, I would do that, or I would say, hey, see those logs that go up like halfway there? I bet I could jump over. You know, and then I would run and, like, get halfway up. And then, you know, I mean, my mom would let, like, they'd take me home in a wagon half the time and just leave me on my front steps. And, you know, my mom would have to come home and be like, the hospital? Yeah, I think we're going to
have to. But seriously, yes? Yeah. So excuse the cheap psychoanalysis here. You're doing that with comedy now. You're taking those leaps with comedy. You really are. No, I'm sorry. That's cheap. But it's true. Cheap but true.
What's interesting about that is people will say, like, are you nervous about doing the rally? And you're like, yeah. So why do it? Well, why not? What, you know, Stephen and I always talk about this, which is when you feel like you want to express yourself, you need an impetus. You need a catalyst. And part of the catalyst is get yourself in trouble. And that's how I got into this business. I got myself in trouble. I moved to New York. There was no reason for me to move here. I was had a very happy life bartending at the bottom half and working for the state of New Jersey. But I wanted to get myself in trouble because I felt like I would not accomplish anything that meant something to me unless I did. And so moving here was a leap of faith, but what if it didn't work out? Then it didn't work out. Life's not, there's no guarantee in any way if you go a simpler path.
You work so hard on the show. It's so obvious how much work you put into writing and performing it and how long your day must be and how it probably never ends, particularly doing an event like this rally. I mean, you're...
You'd be surprised how easily I turn it off when I go home.
Really?
I've gotten really good at when I go home, the kids and I and my, we watch Wizards of Waverly Place and I don't think about it again.
Have you changed the amount of time you're willing to devote to the show and to work now that you're the father of two?
No, I'd rather they suffer. I'd rather not. I figure I'll catch up with them. No, but what I have decided is when I'm home, I'm home. And to me, that's the difference. You know, I can't not be at work, but the real challenge is when I'm at work, I'm at work. I'm locked in, I'm ready to go, I'm focused. When I'm at home, I'm locked in, and I'm ready to go, and I'm focused on home. And we don't watch the show, we don't watch the news, we don't do any of that stuff. I sit down, I play Barbies, and then sometimes the kids will come home and play with me, and then, it just, they're just sitting there. I mean, she's got a horse and a kitchen, and I just think, like, the possibilities. If I'm able to give them my full attention for the amount of time I'm able to give it to them, I prefer that to, I like to turn the switch on and off. And it's still, it'll in times like this, I don't sleep well just because of so much that's going on, but I try not to let it affect me in my waking hours.
Do you take anything? Okay, so...
Manischewitz.
I'm going to read some questions from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
What role does Judaism play in your professional life? How about your personal life?
Gee, I can't believe that came out of the Jewish Y. You know what's great? Flip through that. I bet they're all that. What role does Judaism play in your thing? Next question. Judaism, does it play a role? Next question. Your roles in Judaism, what do you think? What is it again?
What role does Judaism play in your professional life? How about your personal life?
I don't know who asked this question, so let me just direct it to the audience. What do you want me to say?
Let me focus the question for you. I think maybe what they want to hear is, did you ever practice, was being Jewish ever significant to you other than culturally the kind of humor and...
I think I am genetically... I don't know what tribe I'm from, but...
The Henny Youngman tribe.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a... I don't prescribe necessarily to... I don't... there's so many different things that go into Judaism and the cultural aspect of it. I feel like an outsider. So to some extent, I guess... diaspora is in my wheelhouse, but I don't know if that's Judaism or other things or just the way my brain is
wired. Well, you probably feel like an outsider among Jews, too.
That's right. I would consider myself reform in the sense that, for instance, on Yom Kippur this year, I had a bacon, egg, and cheese croissant sandwich. No, I think, I am respectful of those that practice religion. I think that religion is not the sole source of morality in this world. So I'm respectful of it. If that's how you get your center and your bearing, I think that's great. I also think, like anything that powerful, there is a dark side to it that also needs to be addressed and oftentimes isn't because of how delicate subject matter, you know, it can be. So that's generally how I feel. I mean, my wife is Catholic. Neither one of us. We're raising the kids, obviously, to be sad.
We'll hear more of my onstage interview with Jon Stewart after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with Jon Stewart last month at the 92nd Street Y in New York. Here's another question that came from the audience. What is your media diet when you go to serious sources for news?
I read all the papers in the morning, Post, Daily News. The one they hand out by the subway. Sometimes I look at the ticker on the top of the cab. I read a lot of papers. I like, you know, for me, I like the active engagement with the news as opposed to watching it on television. I think it's, boy, that's another thing that I think is really an interesting phenomenon now is the disconnect between television news and news on in the paper and where the
You mean on the news channels?
Well, if you watch the big story on the 24-hour news networks, who are, no question, driving the discourse. They are the most fundamentally important drivers of public opinion and government action, I think. They are an incredibly powerful force. The disconnect between what they view as important and urgent versus what you would see in a more traditional paper is stark and pretty scary.
You give your views of Fox a lot on the show. I mean, you lampoon Fox a lot on the show. What about MSNBC?
Because they're so good.
What about MSNBC?
If they were better at what they did, I think we'd lampoon them more. But they don't, you know, they're, right now, I feel like they're like Dennis the Menace compared to, you know, I mean, Fox News is a brilliant organization. However you feel about their point of view, there's no denying the excellence with which they execute it. And Roger Ailes is a brilliant guy. You know, what stuns me is that nobody can match him, not on the Democratic side, on the liberal side, but on the side of creating a tenacious, non-ideological moral arbiter that earns credibility from people and earns their respect and earns their sources. It's stunning to me that can't be accomplished. Because MSNBC, they're all getting their ass kicked, and CNN, God bless him. I mean, it looks like a clown car just driving around. Like,
what about Rachel Maddow? What do you think?
Say it again.
Rachel Maddow, what do you think?
I think Maddow she's doing a terrific job at presenting the liberal point of view from a well-researched position. Like, she is, I think, an example of a more ideological broadcaster, but who does it, I think, in a, like, with moral clarity. You know, I don't feel like she's a bully pulpit individual. I think hers is a thoughtful liberal pulpit. But, you know, it's MSNBC. The idea that MSNBC is in any way the type of well-oiled machine that Fox is an absolute, it's a non-starter. You know, you got 3 hours of Scarborough. What's Fox News is great is it's almost like if you watch a weather map of how a hurricane starts and how it has to, and it builds, and the whole, and they're a cyclonic, you know, the guys in the morning go, you know, what happens is at night, Hannity will be like, is Barack Obama a socialist who's indoctrinating your children? And then in the morning, they'll come on and go, some people are concerned about socialism in the White House. And you're like, I think that was the guy that was on at 10 o'clock. They feed each other, and what happens is there's no cold water. So the storm just builds and builds and builds. On MSNBC, you get a little bit, it builds here, but then Ed Schultz comes on and you're not really sure what the hell he's talking about. And then it goes to Scarborough in the morning and that's cold water. You know, they don't have the discipline or the narrative to be able to focus it. And I admire what they've done. I'm stunned nobody's copied it. I think the difference is Ailes provides his people with courage and cover. and the other, you know, I don't think it's a there's a lot of smart people out there. I blame the editorial managing people.
Okay, on Crossfire, you argue that your role on TV is different because you host a fake news show on Comedy Central. How do your roles and responsibilities change with the organizing of this rally? Is it fair to argue that your roles and responsibilities don't change?
Sure, it's fair to argue. It's fair to argue everything. I disagree. You know, I think it matters in this world what you label yourself and how you conduct yourself. And that was my argument with CNBC and Jim Cramer. You can't argue, you can't label yourself as, you know, more trusted than God on financial and then deliver what you deliver. I do think there's a difference between the responsibility that journalists have and the responsibility that I have. But like I say, if things are out of context, we will correct them. We're not trying to manipulate things to the point where they lose their intent and meaning. And that's just the way we operate now. But there is this false idea that we have to be fair, that there has to be a fairness in what we do. If you have to find equivalents on each side and all that. It's a wonderful game everybody is playing in that they've misconstrued criticism as persecution. And they've created a great little trap that any criticism of them, however valid, is further proof of the plot that is out to get them and how persecuted they are. And it allows you to escape any of your own sense of thing. You know, what we were arguing on, I don't even care about civil discourse. I don't mind people yelling as long as it's authentic. But what it felt like to me is it was gamed. Crossfire felt like kabuki. I wasn't arguing that you shouldn't have people who disagree on, but I was arguing that there should be some moral authority in the room, earned or otherwise, that has to be able to say, okay, there's a difference between you don't believe that gay people should be able to get married and lying about statistics when it comes to what happens to gay families and children. There's a big difference in that. And there has to be a moral authority in the room to be able to not go, that was an interesting discussion, we'll be right back. But to be able to go, oh, hold on one second, that was bullshit.
Now, you told Paul Begala and Tucker Carlson in a stunning guest appearance on their show Crossfire that they were ruining America.
I was trying to be flippant at the top. You know, I'd always made fun of the show, and I thought I'd come on there and be like, hey, guys, you know, remember all that stuff I was saying about your show? Yeah, I mean that. You're terrible. You know, and I thought they'd be like, oh, that's right. I thought that's funny, and they'd move on. But then they came, you know, I realized they had prepared gotcha questions about how I had softballed John Kerry. And that's when I think, as I say, the alchemy of the moment takes over and you just go, seriously? Okay, let's do this, you know. And that's what happens.
We'll hear more of my onstage interview with John Stewart after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with John Stewart last month at the 92nd Street Y in New York. Here's another question that was given to me by the audience. Someday the Daily Show will end. This sounds very portentous.
Who said this? Is this what's where? Is this how it happens? Is this? Am I being fired?
Do you have any?
From the president of the network, he stands up.
Do you
That's
have
right,
any?
Stewart.
And
it's over.
Do you have any idea, and any is underscored, do you have any idea what comes next for you?
No. You know, I think about it a lot because it is exhausting at times. It's invigorating. I feel that this show uses every part of me and is the best iteration of what I can do in terms of this. But I also think at a certain point, you don't like every part of you being used. And you want to have parts of yourself back that you can use for other purposes. And I think that will ultimately happen.
Like sleep.
Sleep is nice. You don't want to get wound down. I mean, this is not a complaint about, like, you don't understand what it's like in the mines. You know, I'm a turd miner. It's not like, you know. But there will be a certain limit to it. I have other thoughts about what I'd like to do, things I'd like to go back and do stand-up. But the main thing I'd like is when my kids get a little older, I'd just like a little more flexibility.
Right.
You know, it's at a certain point, it's going to be 3 o'clock, and one of them is going to have, let's say, a karate match.
Two people want to know if you actually read the books of the guests you have on.
I read the books, both back, front, cover. It depends on, you know, some weeks we have 4 books, and they can be thick ones and, you know, historical nonfiction. But I read pretty quickly, and I try and read as much of the books as I possibly can, and I have a pretty good ability of getting through it, retaining a good deal of its information for a 4 to 6 hour period, and then having it disappear from my brain.
God, do I know that feeling.
It has like a radioactive half-life. I take it in, and suddenly I'm an expert on the construction of the Pentagon, and then by 8 o'clock that night, I'm like, I didn't know there was a building with 5 sides, you know. You know, it's you take it in and then it's gone. So I cram.
So just one more thing. Do you have like an experience on The Daily Show or as a comic where you say, this is my peak experience, this is as good as it gets, like this is so great?
There was a congressional bill where they were going to get money for first responders for 9/11 for chronic health issues. And it's a no-brainer. The people that went into the towers or were down there searching to have their health bills taken care of. And legislative maneuvering. The Democrats wouldn't bring it up an up or down vote, because if they did that, the Republicans would be allowed to insert amendments. And one of the amendments that they could insert was that you couldn't give any of the money to illegal aliens. And so the Democrats were afraid that they would have a commercial that would be made that would say, you voted to give money to it. So rather than standing up and being moral for the people that risked everything for us down there, they decided to try a legislative maneuver that made it so that 2/3 had to pass the bill so that no amendments could be put in it. And well, the Republicans obviously, you know, shot it down, their own moral failing. So we did a segment on the show called I Give Up. And the ability to articulate our sense of just absolute sadness, but through a prism of comedy, like we came in that morning just really despairing as we watched this go down. And we walked out that night feeling like we had yelled and felt, you know, we put it through the prism and the synthesis and the digestive process that we put it through, and we made ourselves feel better. And we didn't make ourselves feel better by ignoring it, by dismissing it, by not dealing with it. We made ourselves feel better by expressing our utter rage at the ineptness and lack of courage from our legislators. And we walked out of there that night feeling like, you know what? Good day's work. And that was it. Well,
I would love to talk to you for hours, and I have a feeling our audience would love to listen to you for hours, but I am sadly required
sunrise,
to end it about now.
Sunset. Thank you. Oh, yeah.
My interview with Jon Stewart was recorded September 29th on stage at the 92nd Street Y in New York. The occasion for our interview was the publication of the new Daily Show book, A Visitor's Guide to the Human Race. Our thanks to Susan Engel at the Y and the Y's technical crew, as well as Stephen Barclay and Kira McGrath. You'll find links to interviews with other people from The Daily Show and The Colbert Report on our website, freshair.npr.org. Monday on our show, we'll hear from Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards, who has a new autobiography. Here's one of the first songs he co-wrote with Mick Jagger that he thought was really right for the Stones. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. We have additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR.
Rolling Stones guitarist Keith Richards used to sleep with a tape recorder and a guitar by his bed. One morning, he woke up to find he'd recorded something after he went to sleep. He played the tape and found the idea for the song that became Satisfaction.
And after that, there's 40 minutes of me snoring.
Keith Richards talks about his new autobiography on the next Fresh Air.